Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. My name is Valerie Nielsen. I'm the Interim Executive Director at the Palm Beach Transportation Planning Agency, and we're so excited to have you here today with us to talk about one of my favorite topics, mobility and economic development. I want to thank all of you for taking the time to join us this morning. Thank you to our board members. We have a few here today, our chair, Mayor Weinroth, our council member Joni Brinkman, Vice Mayor Chelsea Reed, and council member Jeff Hamara. So thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you to all of you. I want to thank TPA staff for helping us set up today. We have, if you're not familiar with our offices, we have bathrooms right out this door to the right, coffee, water, and snacks in the kitchen out that door as well. So, and we have an amazing, amazing lineup of rock star speakers this morning. I'm going to introduce them. We are going to be doing presentations and leaving the questions until the end. So you might see a postcard at your seat for you to write down a question. And Melissa Murray, our PR director in the lovely pink dress, will be collecting your questions and she'll be reading them back to us at the end of our panel session. Any questions we don't get to, we will follow up with you. So please write your email down as well. And with that, I'm going to introduce our panel. We have Jonathan Hopkins, the Vice President of Mobility with Brightline Trains here to talk about what they're doing. We also have Kelly Smallridge, President and CEO of the Palm Beach County Business Development Board, to talk about economic development in Palm Beach County. We also have Gopal Rajagowda from giving us the private sector perspective from Related Southeast, and also Rafael Clemente, Executive Director of the West Palm Beach DDA, Downtown Development Authority. And also we have here Alex Esposito, who's the co-founder of Circuit, a local circulator here in downtown, to give us a just general overall perspective on micromobility trends that are happening overall and how that connects with mobility. And then finally, I'm going to give a little bit of an overview from the TPA's perspective and some of the things we're looking at and where we're going with mobility. So with that, I'll get started. We'll have each of the speakers come and speak from the podium and then take turns. And again, we'll take questions at the end. Please write those down on your postcard. So with that, I want to welcome Jonathan Hopkins, the Vice President of Mobility with Brightline Trains. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Valerie. It's a pleasure to be here. And I always love my time in West Palm Beach. I just moved here from Seattle about 6 or 7 months ago. And so it's a delight to be with you guys all today. So we're going to talk a little bit about why we're doing what we're doing at Brightline, and then talk also about some of the lessons that go into that. So as Valerie mentioned, I'm the VP of Mobility at Brightline. And how do we make it go? Oh, there we go. Just a little bit of a delay. Okay, and so we're going to talk about the journey to Brightline 2.0. I think probably many people here who rode before the pandemic on Brightline. Okay, so everybody's experienced before the pandemic and afterwards. The way I like to characterize Brightline 1.0, you know, very exciting. We had fast trains, great hospitality, and people loved it, right? If you rode the train, you absolutely loved it. It's still just a train. You have three stations, just a train. But if you got on it, you would love it and you'd come back. But we also learned during that time that of our non-riders in our prospective service area, about 35% of them said the reason they didn't ride was it's hard to get to the station. Well, you see where our station is in West Palm Beach. If it's hard to get to the station, where else is it hard to get to in West Palm Beach? Every place where it's dense, it's hard to get to downtown. So the problems that on at least perception wise with many people in South Florida that aren't riding a different type of mobility. And again, our mission as a company is to create great travel experiences so Americans fall in love with rail again. And so in that context, it's not about having all of you guys ride the train a lot by itself. It's having all the other people that are jamming up I-95 thinking about a different way to go that can make them happier, make travel safer, and make for just a more accessible South Florida. So when 35% of our non-riders say it's hard to get to our stations, well, that's a problem. We have to find a way to fix it. So Brightline 2.0 is focused on actually on mobility. So as the VP of mobility, I'm in charge of everything that moves that's not a train, right? And so basically first and last mile mobility. So the vision that we have that we're still on the way to realizing is how do we get great connectivity to our stations, you know, good integrations with public transit, how do we have bike share and scooters and even a car service engaged so people feel like in a carefree way like the train is carefree. You get on it and you get to where you're going. How do we make it car-free, carefree, getting there, at least more eco-friendly if you're riding an electric vehicle? And so overall, like we like to think of our stations as fantastic mobility hubs. And there's a long list of principles that go along with mobility hubs, having great real-time information, having a variety of tools that can get you to and from the station, and then integrating them all well. Miami is the biggest station, is kind of the largest model of that, but we're doing that in every station. And that's why we've invested in all of these services. We have, all electric Teslas, we have shared vans, we have circuit vehicles that Alex will be talking later here today. And we invested in bike share here in West Palm Beach because there was not a micro mobility option. And as a way, like West Palm Beach is phenomenal compared to almost any city in the country for its walkability and ability to get around without a car in a delightful way, going places that you're going to love. So we wanted to make sure there's the appropriate array of options to do that. Because one of our goals as a company is to help invite more people from Miami and Fort Lauderdale come up here and experience West Palm Beach, go to great restaurants here, see wonderful things. Because, trust me, I know, like once you come here, you're going to love it. So those are the tools that we've been implementing that I've been responsible for deploying and continue to roll out more integrations over the course of the next year before we launch. If you guys don't know, Orlando will be opening in around Q1 of 2023. And so we'll have people going both directions out of West Palm Beach and loving it. Behind all of that is some experience and some principles that are universal. And in my history, I've worked at Uber, I've worked at Lime, but I also headed an organization called Commute Seattle, which is a transportation management association, one of the two largest in the country, and has a pretty amazing track record driven by data that we'll show you today of helping a region grow while not increasing the number of cars or widening roads. And I think this is really relevant because when I'm now living in South Florida, I see the same thing that I experienced in Seattle, a place with massive growth, huge potential. Seattle for 10 years is the fastest growing city in the country. South Florida, some of the cities here are like top three for growth in the country. So how do you prepare for that? We can't just keep doing what we're doing because the roads are clogged. So we have to figure out other options. So we'll talk through some of the lessons that we're applying at Brightline. And a lot of them come from Seattle. The largest one is, well, here's what Seattle did to accept tons of growth. They gave car-free incentives like transit passes to employees. They got more riders. That resulted in improved service and improved infrastructure because riders wanted better. And that created space for more jobs. And could you raise your hand if you're opposed to more jobs? If you think jobs are a bad thing, right? Everybody wants everybody to be employed. And it's great if it's in your community. You don't want all the jobs in somebody else's community. That means it requires access. So those are the principles that we found after 25 years of collecting data. And why is all of those, and are there all those incentives important? It's because you really have a geometry problem, right? If you double the jobs in West Palm Beach, do you have to double the size of the roads? West Palm Beach has already decided that. Concurrency got thrown out in the 90s because it just doesn't make any sense. You have to start leveling buildings that you love in order to make places for the cars that you don't. For 95% of the time when you're not driving them, they're just sitting there. So to solve this geometry problem, we had to convince people to try something different. I mean, the geometry is pretty stunning. The space you take up in a car is about 100 square feet if it's just you riding in the car. The space you take up on a train is 5. So think about the multiple effect of how many more people you can get into a city, a place that people love, whether you're a tourist or coming to work. And guess what? People do ride trains. We're proof of it. So having these sorts of solutions is really important. But how did we get there? I've noted this is data from 2017, 2018, but Seattle in 1 year had 20% of the commercial development of any downtown in the country, of all downtowns summed up across the country. Seattle had 20% of it, had more cranes than any city in the United States. So massive growth, and we had to have a way to deal with that. From 2010 to 2017, we added 60,000 jobs in the downtown core. If you extend this 2 more years, there's 100,000 jobs in the downtown core. That's on a base of 200,000 jobs. That was a 50% jobs increase in less than a decade. Why? Mostly Amazon and the things that supported Amazon. Luckily, we'd accidentally maybe implemented good policies 20 years prior to that that had helped us deal with this. Because when you think about 60,000 jobs and you wanted to create parking for that, this is what it would look like. If it was surface parking, it would cover every block of downtown Seattle, every single block, just to handle the growth in jobs. And I'm talking about the growth in jobs of 60,000. And I know some people here, like GoPuL knows we can do multi-story parking. And so, you know, GoPuL told me, oh, we'll just put this on parking tower. So we mocked that up, had some architects look at it. We're pretty sure it would look like this. You know, so it's just a nice parking tower. Of course, Mount Rainier is still out. So maybe the locals will be happy with that, but this certainly wouldn't pass design review. So we decided it was probably be important to do something different. And instead of just, you know, paving over all of the buildings that we like, we actually said, okay, let's change the behavior. And in 2010, 35% of our employees were driving a single occupancy vehicle. And in 2017, only 25% were. And that creates a pretty, pretty stunning statistical change where you actually, over that period of time, end up with 4,000 less cars entering the downtown than you had 7 years prior, after adding 60,000 jobs. And these stats continue to pace. When we added, you know, if you had two more years, it was still about the same. Basically, in 2010, we had about 75,000 cars entering for commuting purposes into downtown Seattle. And we still have about 75,000 cars, because you've reached the limit of those tubes. You have to make the tubes more efficient, tubes being roads. The biggest way we did that was investments in transit, but we really had to use an all of the above strategy. Transit just has the most capacity to improve because of like that multiple effect, 5 square feet per person versus 100 square feet per person. And do we want jobs? The answer is yes. But you know, everybody, it's kind of like looking at Amsterdam and you say, well, we want bike lanes, but we'll never be Amsterdam, so we might as well not do it. Seattle wasn't Seattle 2019 or 2021 either. We spent 100 years not doing anything. Like in fact, like this is a timeline with population growth in blue. You know, we had streetcars and then we tore them out. We tried to pass transit measures to build a subway. So, you know, everybody got rid of their 200 miles of streetcars that kind of built the modern Seattle city, were torn out in 1940. We've been 100 years trying to pass transit measures. 1912, we tried to pass one. 1960s, 1968, 1970, we did as well. And then there was a big downturn. There weren't enough votes for it. But something started to change in the 90s. We built gold-plated BRT with a 1.3-mile tunnel into downtown Seattle that got buses off of the streets. That increased transit ridership a lot. And after that, we started passing transit measures for light rail. In 1996, a $3 billion measure. We tried to build a monorail, watch The Simpsons, the monorail song that was inspired by Seattle. And then passed a 50-mile, $17, $18 billion measure in 2008. And then added more bus service. The city started funding county bus service. So with that investment, they started out with 25% of the population had a 10-minute frequency bus within a 10-minute walk. That number is now 75%. When you improve the service, more people ride it. And then in 2016, we passed a $54 billion transit measure. So basically $73 billion worth of transit investments have been passed over a 20-year period. But that didn't all happen by accident. It wasn't just because. We had a golden era of policies that helped that happen. In the early 90s, 1991, we passed a Growth Management Act saying grow up, not out. And then the transit agency and the university realized when the University of Washington wanted to expand, and this is a key because universities can be a key tool to start the change in behavior. When the university wanted to expand, the community said, we need to roll back traffic 8 years or we won't let you. And so they gave every student a free transit pass where the students paid like $8 a month, but they use it on an unlimited amount. They started using transit more. And then the next year we authorized regional transit authorities. We're a region of just 3 million people in Seattle. This region is 6.6 million. The barriers created by county lines are real, and they do sometimes prevent regional action. And then in 1993, they took that lesson from the university and applied it to all employers. So they created an employer transit pass that the TMA, Commute Seattle, sold to employers. Now 60% of people riding public transit in Seattle are riding for free because it's paid for by their employee. No other city has that stat. And so this is from 2003, I think, Seattle's transit ridership growth compared to all the other cities, major cities. And you see it's deeply divergent. It's because we invested in it. We have 25 miles of light rail. We have regional buses that are part of a seamless network. And we have people riding public transit for free because people, no matter what your income, like free things. So kind of the takeaway from this is this model that worked in Seattle can actually work anywhere. You know, you give people a financial incentive to try something new, they're more likely to do it. There's more riders and like Palmtran, like if it has more riders, they're gonna demand better service. Improved service and improved infrastructure, the reason I show this slide at the end is this is actually what Brightline is. Like, it's improved infrastructure. And the lesson from this virtuous cycle, as we like to call it, is that you just have to start. You just have to start, do something, and then keep on building. So with our investment in infrastructure that has helped being very beneficial for north-south commutes in West Palm, how do we leverage that to add other investments and complement it? Some of the best work on reducing car use and getting more jobs into, in the downtown example, was a collaboration between the public and private sectors that has produced tremendous results, and it's possible to do anywhere. So that's the presentation for now, and I'll hand out back to Valerie.
Thank you. And thanks, Kelly, for highlighting a lot of what we're doing here. I guess from our perspective, from the related company's perspective, I can give the private sector perspective here. And obviously, being the owner of all the Class A office buildings downtown, we have seen a lot over the years. My partners came here 25 years ago to build City Place. I've been coming here for about 10 years. I moved here about 6.5 years ago, and there's been a lot of change, as we all know. I feel we're in an unprecedented moment at this moment. What has happened from pre-COVID to post-COVID and the acceleration of growth here is tremendous. To put things in perspective for us, we control about 2.3 million square feet of uses downtown between office, hotel, retail, and residential. But on the drawing boards today, we have 4.5 to 6 million square feet of development in the downtown if we pull it all off over the next five to 10 years. So there's a huge opportunity here to build a lot and to proceed forward. But I think on this topic of mobility, it's incredibly important alongside education and housing to get people around. So slide here again, tying in with what Kelly said, the momentum is swinging south. I mean, there's no doubt you've read all the articles. The finance companies are here and they're hovering to relocate here or set up satellite offices down here. These are some of the firms that we've leased spaces to, some of the top financial firms in the world, not only New York based. Over the last 18 months, we've leased about 500,000 square feet, which about 80% of those companies are new to market. Again, to put that in perspective, we built a building in 2008. I was not involved in it. It's called City Place Office Tower. We recently bought the building back. I think that's a first for the company, where we built a building, sold it, and bought it back. But that building, when my partners built it, was a story of moving tenants around in the market from other office buildings to that building. That's what the market was. It was an internal growth market. Now we're talking about external growth here. And our feeling is, based on the conversations we're having right now at this moment, this is really just the tip of the iceberg. Again, tied in with what Kelly said, the migration here to Florida is real. She mentioned 41% of New Yorkers from the Northeast are moving to Palm Beach County versus Dade and Broward. And then again, it's a young and educated workforce. This is a big change here. The average age in West Palm Beach is 37 years versus, for example, on Palm Beach Island, the average age being 69. So a lot of these companies that we're talking to today are very focused on how are you related? They look at us and they say, how are you going to make this a place for our young talent? Because if not, we're not going to be able to operate here. So a lot of what we're focusing on is placemaking. Certainly thinking about mobility, education, housing, all these components are very important to the larger story of attracting the migration that we have in front of us as a huge opportunity, I think, in the Southeast to drive this market to finance for sure. But I think with University of Florida, next slide, with University of Florida, hopefully on the way, I see that some of the county members are here. This is another game changer, right? Because even though this market has traditionally been finance oriented, and a lot of the recent leasing we're doing is finance oriented, we believe that tech could come here, right? And University of Florida can really be a catalyst for that. But tech at the moment, we know, is going to Miami. Miami is what, you know, a lot of these tech companies know from the West Coast and from New York. But we think that West Palm Beach is a great place for tech. So once University of Florida gets kicked off with the verticals in artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, crypto and blockchain, sustainability, all the above, we think that's going to draw more tenants and more tech tenants in that category. And of course, connectivity. Jonathan, I'm a huge fan of the Brightline. I used it quite a bit pre-COVID, and I've been using it, since. And I do not drive to Miami. My wife grew up half her life in Miami. We go to Miami often. I have not driven to Miami since the Brightline has opened, and I refuse to do it because being a New Yorker, I hate driving. First of all, we have one car, and I walk to work every day because I live close to my office. So I think, you know, again, thinking about mobility, thinking about what's happening in some of the other great cities around the country, connectivity is one of the most important things that we could tackle from a public and private partnership. And if we get it right, this is going to be, again, I'm speaking specifically West Palm Beach and Palm Beach, which is where we are doing a lot of our work, but Palm Beach County as a whole, right? Because not only do people live in the downtown, they live around Palm Beach County in a 25-mile radius from West Palm Beach. So there you go. We can't just look at West Palm because our radius is really Palm Beach County from a live and work perspective. And certainly for the square retail that we have, we draw up to Jupiter, west to Wellington, south down to Boca del Rey. And now with the Brightline, of course, south to Miami. And we're grateful that now that train is going to connect to Orlando by the end of the year and hopefully operational, Jonathan, first quarter of next year. So we think that, you know, the international tourists now could come through West Palm once that gets finished. So this is a site plan of the square neighborhood, showing all the assets we control here. This was part of a city placed district of regional impact, 72 acre development, again, that was conceived 26 years ago in 1996, opened 22 years ago in 2000. And since the last 6.5 years ago, we've been reimagining it, but it goes south from the Hilton and the Convention Center, Restoration Hardware, and then north all the way to Avernia, where the Brightline is. So if you've been to the project, you've probably noticed that over the last few years, we've reimagined the streetscape. We've kind of put a pretty distinct landscaping program in. We've put in a public art program, and we've emphasized mobility and walkability and comfort in the district. So it's completely changed the look and feel of it. And moving north of Hibiscus, which I think the next slide will show, we have 8 to 9 buildings in pre-development. One is under construction, which is 575 Rosemary, which was a site that we bought Macy's out of its ground lease. And now we're doing a 21-story luxury residential building with retail and office, with 15% of those units being workforce housing. So we have the assets here in the square. And then on the waterfront, Phillips Point, Esperante, and then One Flagler, which is under development and very successfully being leased at the moment. I think that's all I got. Thank you.
Everyone, see everybody. So we just heard some of the most important private sector partners ask for transit. So I'm going to try to, first I'm going to start by telling us how we got to where we are in downtown with a little look back, and then try to give us a path forward in how we can do more in our region to support what has just been described as a need for our place. No good development happens by accident. This is all intentional, right? We all have heard the term urban planning, but it is critically important. How do you design a place? How you design a place determines how that place functions or not, or how it doesn't function. This is a snapshot of our first master plan. It's 100 years old, I think, this year. John Nolan, an acolyte of Frederick Law Olmsted. Frederick Law Olmsted, we know that name, one of the most influential public space planners and park designers in history. John Nolan designed West Palm Beach, Lake Park, Lakeland, St. Petersburg, Venice, and a lot of cities around the country. And his plan contemplated a compact, walkable place because that's what cities were. That wasn't unique. It wasn't called traditional neighborhood development. It was called city planning. What his plan didn't contemplate, and it came to be, a lot of the things that were designed in Nolan's original plan happened. Some of them didn't. What he didn't anticipate was everything that happened, say, post-war. In the bullseye there in the circle is downtown. That squiggly line about a third of the way up the image, two-thirds of the way up the image, is I-95. What wasn't contemplated in Nolan's plan was everything that happened to the west. Suburban sprawl happened across the United States. And when that happened, our downtowns saw disinvestment, people moving away from them and out of them, and they fell into disrepair. What am I showing you with this slide? This is downtown in like the 70s or maybe 80s. What I'm showing you is all the space for moving and storing cars. because we thought at the time the prevailing wisdom was everyone left downtown. Let's blow our roads out and make parking lots to invite everyone to come back downtown. But that was a counterintuitive approach, I should say. Because it created places people didn't want to be. My point in showing you this image is that if we're going to get to mobility and transit and land uses that are supportive of those things, we have to think first about how to design for people. That's the key piece of how we get to transit usage. So West Palm Beach did a big visionary thing. Some of you were here for this. The Downtown Master Plan of 1994 under Mayor Nancy Graham, our first strong mayor, had four goals in that plan. These are the four goals, the only goals defined in the plan. Everything else fell under these four goals. Every one of them is a human-centric statement. A lot of our cities, a lot of our region, I think, can look at this model and use it. Does every place need to have a downtown core like West Palm Beach? Absolutely not. Can we create nodes of density and mixed use? Yes, we can. And once we get that at a scale that is appropriate for those places, we start to get toward a transit supportive region. The bottom one, right? The bottom one says it all. Make downtown more pedestrian friendly. And you could basically copy and paste that into a regional plan. And then this, a very important document. I love this opening statement. The city of West Palm Beach is conducting several visionary and progressive initiatives downtown. The intent of these initiatives is to build a great city. Mixed use, beautiful, promotion of non-automobile modes. Again, a human-centric approach. Basically, what we did was we flipped the prevailing approach at the time of how do we move cars to how do we design for people. The napkin sketch that saved the world, at least the downtown. And you see at the top of that image there on the right, anthropology, design, urban democracy, and planning. These are big, high ideals, but that's really how we get to placemaking. Everything happens here. The mixing zone, the magic triangle. This is what keeps me up at night, Kelly. How do we make this the best it can be? That's where the private sector, the development, the Gopals of the world, and the public sector collaborate. What's the building look? How's that building frontage work? And how's the public space accommodate the humans in that space? This is where people experience their city, their neighborhood, their park, whatever it is. This is where we need to really think about design. The roadway, we know how to move cars. We can move cars, we can design roads for that. What we're not good at right now is designing places for people and helping them decide to get out of their car. We've done a lot of things, and I'll go through this quick. Just one example of experimentation and pilot programs in downtown. This was a parklet. That's a super temporary 1 or 2 day thing we did a few years ago. We turned that into a design. We put that on the street for 3 months in 3 different places to see what people thought of it. Could people tolerate losing a parking space for more human space, for more people space? And when those went away, we got in a lot of trouble because people wanted them to stay there. So we wound up changing our street design to accommodate more people. And you can see that original clematis design I showed you in that dead downtown picture, 3 lanes, 1 way, three quarters of the space for cars, 1/4 of the space for people. That is not an urban place. That is not a place that people want to be in. In the 90s, we went to this 2/3 for cars, 1/3 for people. And this is where we are today. Almost a balance, roughly a balance. And we're going to use this approach in other places in downtown where it's appropriate. Just some, you know, examples. I know walk score is just an algorithm, but walk score gives us a lot of good data, at least a snapshot. 2016, we were at 84, 2022, we're at 96. You can see transit is, it's okay. Circuit, I wonder that they probably don't know Circuit is here now because that would beef us up. That commute, you blew my mind because we're 25% of people commuting without their car. You were 25% of people commuting with their car, right? We have a long way to go, but we can get there. This is a bad graphic, but this is downtown, our city, and our region. You can see that most of the people in our region, the only people that are really using transit are the people that have no other option. This is an equity issue that needs to be addressed, not just a economic development issue. It's a real equity issue, people. Trip generation. This is a challenge, and I was excited to present this today, because right now we are still using a one-size-fits-all approach to how we forecast and model trips, and also build the impact fee structure and roadway program around it. So this is a page from the Palm Beach Traffic Division Trip Generation Manual, and a hypothetical of 5,000 square foot office somewhere, anywhere, whether it's downtown or whether it's in rural Palm Beach or gardens or anywhere else, is projected to produce 73 trips a day. But in an urban place or in a place that has mobility options, this is an office. This is SmartX. If you know those guys, Aaron Wormis and company, 200 Clematis, 6,000 square feet of office. He pulled all the employees in that office, 24 employees, every day for a week. And this is their average total daily trips, average per day. And that count of 73 is roughly right, but they're not all car trips. But the trip generation model doesn't contemplate that. Right now in downtown, we're seeing a lot of walking trips. Who came here without their car today? A third, 25%. But if we were here and we were going to lunch or going to coffee, we wouldn't drive from where we're at right now. We would go somewhere on our feet. So this is what's happening on the ground in places that have transit and walkable supportive environments. Who's using it and how's it happening? This is an important thing. This was bicycle parking counts in the Clematis district. This is just Clematis Street from Narcissus to Rosemary, including the alleyways behind all those ground floor businesses. Average AM and PM peak hour bike parking, 100. A little context, the Banyan Garage only holds 405 cars, right? 400 cars when? Banyan Garage? I'm looking at you.
Oh, yes.
Yes. I knew you would know that number. Not you. I'm so sorry, Joni. What do you know about our parking system? So the 25% of our Banyan Garage is left open for other users because this is happening. We have a parking problem, cars and other modes, and this is who's using that. As a three-decade bike commuter, when I walk around downtown and I look at the bikes, I'm sure that's not, most of those bikes is not somebody going to yoga or coffee with a friend. I know who those riding those bikes because I come from my neighborhood and I ride with all those people into downtown. And this isn't all at once. Rocco's doesn't have 88 people there at one time. That's across all shifts on all days. But this is just a snapshot of the employment base of our hospitality and restaurant sector in our downtown, which is a major economic engine. It's a major draw of all the folks who are coming to tenant related buildings and who Kelly is helping recruit here is because we have a vibrant place. So this, again, an equity thing. Now, if there's one thing you leave today with from my presentation, I want it to be this. This is one square mile of typical Western community development. It's not good or bad, it's just different. In this one square mile, there's about 300 or 400 residential units, probably a few jobs at a country club or a community center, definitely jobs maintaining and space, but there's jobs around base where people come there, do their maintenance and they go. If you drop that one square mile frame around our downtown district, there are 10,000 or more residents. There's about 8 million square feet of commercial, about 2 million square feet of retail, 2 train stations, a bus terminal, about 30,000 jobs. But we're using the same policy approach to service this as we are to service this. So I looked for the greatest, most extreme analogy I could find, and it's like if we had to care for these animals. Am I having a delay? If we were caring for animals and we treated the elephant the same way we treated the sparrow, it just doesn't make sense. They're two very different things. We need to treat them differently in our care and feeding. Same thing for our development patterns. We need to be nimble with our policy. Just very quick, I'm probably running out of time, but transit supportive of density. I'm sorry, density supportive of transit. You can see the downtown, and that's this little snapshot. Why am I showing this? Because we have the opportunity in places like Palm Beach Gardens, in Boca Raton, and Royal Palm Beach to build in nodes of density. Does it have to be 25-story buildings? No. Can it be 3 to 5 stories in the right location? Yes. Those buildings are already happening, but we need to design the land use pattern so it works better to support walkability, transit, et cetera, multimodal. Very quickly, our city, our mayor has outlined a three-pronged approach in his policy to achieving mobility, safety, equity, and economic development. And that's all around the idea of a 15-minute city. Can you live in or work or visit a place and get all the things you need within a 15-minute zone? What does that look like? It looks like that. It's not an anti-car approach. It's a pro-options approach. Can we build a few other pipes that aren't just single-occupant vehicle trips to bring more people to our place, to feed employment, to bring in new jobs, to accommodate all those jobs? And it's what's being asked for. We just heard that loud and clear. It's what's being asked for from our biggest employers. Snapshot of what's happening in downtown. Within a 15-minute walk or a 10-minute bike ride, you get to a lot of stuff. I live and work in this zone, fortunately. I feel blessed to do so, but I also know that we could replicate this in other places throughout our region. We talked a lot about Circuit. Kelly, your endorsement of that is the best, most powerful endorsement of any program that we've had for mobility. So thank you for saying that. And we're going to get that. Alex and I agreed we're going to get that clip from today's presentation and put it out there, right? So what's going on? We didn't start Circuit. It was Alex and his team. But what we did in October was we entered into a contract with them to subsidize operation, to make it free if the ride begins in or ends in the downtown core. And you can see what happened starting in October. Rides jumped up. Last month, we had 3,500 rides and 5,800 passengers. 3,500 rides, right? Let's just say each one of those was a car that came down and parked somewhere. The Avernia garage, the big garage back here, that's like 7 Avernia garages. Just thinking about what else the opportunity cost, right, of not having options, this is opening up greater capacity for us just by putting a service like this in place. It's worth every single penny. And it's only getting better. Now we have to figure out how to grow it because the demand is getting to the point where we can't keep up. And I'll leave you with this. This is our future. We all have a role in achieving this outcome. And yes, our future as a successful place that has high quality of life, that is sustainable, that achieves environmental goals, is multimodal. And that's it.
Thank you. Thank you, Raphael. And thanks, Kelly, for the kind words. I'm Alex Esposito. I'm the co-founder and CEO at Circuit. And Circuit's a tech-enabled electric shuttle service that operates here in downtown. We've been fortunate to work with a number of cities in California and Texas, here in South Florida, and up in New York, to provide on-demand last-mile shuttle services. And in doing so, we've given over 5 million rides without burning an ounce of gas or traveling more than a few miles. And so I'm not here to just promote Circuit, thank you very much to the kind words that have been said, but really highlight some of the lessons learned and some of the value that we've found in all different types of short range, last mile, and micro mobility types of solutions that are out there. So the way we move matters. And unfortunately today, too many people are using the same forms of transportation to go a mile down the street in the city as they do to go 10 miles to the airport. Wherever cities are growing, traffic's getting worse. And it's time we start to plan ahead for that. And we look at different options for short range travel so we can make it more accessible, greener, and more efficient so that people can leave their cars at home. Because traffic is worse today than it's ever been. And it's arguably one of the biggest problems that cities face. And I say that because it affects us in so many different ways. It's bad for our health. It's bad for the environment, bad for our quality of life. It's bad for economic activity. And it's really a simple problem. There's just too many cars on the road. So how do we get people out of vehicles? And specifically, how do we get people out of vehicles for short trips? Unfortunately, you know, well, mass transit as a whole is the best way that you can reduce traffic. I think Jonathan's slides showing the difference of a train and a car. And I know a train from Brooklyn to New York City can carry about 1,000 people. So that's a lot of cars and that's a lot of traffic. And so one of the problems is getting people to the trains. How do we get people to the trains to encourage that utilization? And ultimately, if we can do that, we can get people out of their cars and get them into short range electric vehicles that are shared and are making these local connections. Because a third of all vehicle trips in the US are just 2 miles or less. And about 48% of all vehicle trips are 3 miles or less. So that's the part of the market that we're focused on. And one of the ones that I think is unfortunately been overlooked for a long time. What we do at Circuit, which is again, just one of the solutions that's out there, is pretty simple. It's an on-demand app. So it acts very much like an Uber or Lyft. If your pickup and drop off is within the geofenced coverage area, then you can get a ride. Some of the differences are a W-2 local driver will come and pick you up. The car is 100% electric and that ride will be shared. So you'll be picking people up along the way to maximize butts and seats and reduce number of cars on the road. So what we're doing is just taking the rider experience that the public has shown us they like about the rideshare services and deploying it in a more controlled fashion that aligns with the quality control, the job creation, the economic and sustainability benefits that our communities need. And so the last mile gets talked a lot as it relates to connecting to transit, which is incredibly important. That's trains, that's buses, that's transit centers. But there's also short trips that happen around a city. And if we can get two people to ride together going in the same direction, then we're reducing vehicle miles traveled. And the other big value add is reducing the demand for parking. So about a third of all vehicle trips and about a third of all traffic in a city is the result of people looking for parking. So if we can cut down on those trips and cut down on all three of these use cases with one solution, then we're creating a benefit that sort of stretches across the entire area. And these types of services have been popping up all over South Florida and all over the country. Both public partnerships, private partnerships, and public-private partnerships. And so it's been interesting to me to see how the service has been embraced by shopping malls, by transit-oriented developments, by employment centers, by hotels, and by cities. And even within cities, we've seen economic development departments embrace the service, parking departments embrace the service. And even some of the transit agencies as well. And what we've done, and a lot of other transportation options do this, is we work with advertising partners. We tie them in. We tie those revenues into the program to reduce the costs. And we've designed these in a way that actually enhances the passenger experience without becoming a huge distraction. excuse me. And there's, again, a lot of options out there. And there's been studies that have shown how a protected bike lane can have a huge increase in bike ridership. Autonomous vehicles have made some considerable headway. People have shown us that they really like the flexibility of the scooters. And ultimately, people like options. And I think it's incredibly important that we pay attention to what people like, because in doing so, they'll use it and it gets cheaper. The cost per rider is a really important metric in transportation and one that's largely overlooked. I'd argue that we spend a lot of time looking at the numerator here. How many people, what did this service cost? How much money did we get back from fares and ad revenue divided by how many people rode it? Well, if we pay attention to the denominator and make a service that people actually want to use, then we're creating the net effect, the same net effect, and we're actually reducing that cost per rider. And we've seen this happen in some of our services. Working with the city of Hollywood, Florida, they were running a fixed route bus that unfortunately was underperforming. And by working with them, they were able to save about 30%, but then the ridership more than doubled. So the real story was that the cost per rider fell by about 80%. And then the flexibility of the service was showcased during COVID, where we actually moved some of the cars to help deliver boxes of groceries to the senior population. Then in Pompano this summer, we saw the lowest cost per rider of any on-demand system in the country. And again, that's just because it's a service that people really want to use. And then here in West Palm Beach, it's just been incredible working with Rafael and with Jonathan here and a number of stakeholders. And again, similar theme. There's a lot of people that are finding value in this, from reduction in parking, connections to mass transit, and other options. You know, with just three cars, we've been able to do the numbers that Rafael shared. And we saw a big uptick when we first started the service. And then we've seen continuous 15% month over month growth of ridership. And it's really been a great connection of working with different public and private partners and advertising partners to deliver a service for the community that's being highly utilized. And then with Brightline, and you know, there's a lot of these different things. You know, I think a scooter is just as good as a circuit if it's going to get somebody to mass transit and get them to connect. But you can take out your phone with Brightline Plus, have a car waiting for you, get to the train, book your train ticket over your phone, and then have a car waiting for you on the other side. So when we think about impact, it's not just getting from here to the train station. Now somebody didn't drive from West Palm Beach to Miami. And that's really the bigger impact that we're creating that starts here, but really resonates across the entire South Florida region. And we like to think of the last mile as the glue that kind of keeps everything together. I think it's really important. We try to take the approach, and other companies take the same approach of not trying to compete with Lyft and Uber or compete with mass transit. We really want to be that glue that keeps it all together. And there's been a lot of studies. 0.6 miles is kind of this magical number where people don't want to walk anymore and ridership starts to fall. I don't know why it's that number. Maybe it's a 10 to 15 minute walk. But if you see, there's great transit options here already. We just need to find ways to get more people to them, whether it be with a bike lane or a shared electric shuttle. Because you can see there's a handful of those 0.6 mile gaps right here. And then obviously the same is true. So I think we can, in Palm Beach County, create a very similar service to Brightline Plus, where you can use transit to get to transit and then use transit to get from transit and really reduce the number of vehicles on the road in the county. The impact comes in a variety of ways. You know, APTA says that a dollar invested in transportation leads to a $5 return in economic activity. We've seen people use the service to get to local businesses, get to work. It's expanded access to jobs. And of course, the electric nature of the vehicles has also reduced emissions in the area. So it's really been a great experience in a lot of these communities, and other programs are seeing the same types of impact. And ultimately, the future of cities doesn't involve single occupancy vehicles. And we're working with some great partners today, and there's a lot of companies out there that are doing the same to try to provide mobility options that align with user behavior and how people want to go and are being highly utilized and reducing the number of vehicles on the road. So thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Amazing presentations, and surprisingly, we're ahead of time. So that means more time for questions. But before we get to that, I'm going to present a little bit about the TPA. And before I start with that, just a reminder, if you have questions, there's a note card at your seat. Melissa's going to go around and collect those for Q&A at the end. And also, if you are a planner, that's AICP, this event is you are eligible for 2 credits, thanks to the Palm Beach Planning Congress and our friend Seth in the back who made it happen. So, but with that, how many are you? You're all here at the TPA, but how many of you are familiar or know what the TPA is, the Palm Beach TPA? Yeah, kind of. Okay. some folks. Well, thank you for joining us today. We are a federally mandated agency for urbanized area from federal and state dollars that we prioritize, plan, and fund. We have a board of 21 locally elected officials, which I mentioned earlier. Thank you so much to our chair, Mayor Weinroth, Councilmember Joni Brinkman, our vice chair, Vice Mayor Reed, Commissioner McKinley, who joined us, and also Councilman Jeff Hamara. But we have this board of 21 locally elected officials, and we collaboratively plan, prioritize, and fund the transportation system with state and federal dollars. Our vision is a safe, efficient, and connected multimodal transportation system. And I know today we've been spending a lot of time focusing on the urban core of downtown, and some of this, you know, we are experiencing growth. We're experiencing, it's a geography and a geometry problem of space. But we are a very large county with 39 municipalities. About half of our roadways are owned by the Department of Transportation, about half are owned by the county, and then some change is owned across the 39 municipalities. So when the TPA, we prioritize the state and federal dollars on the DOT system, on the state system, about half of the roadways. And we also provide grants to the local municipalities and the counties. But we have to work collaboratively with all these partners, the county, the cities, Tri-Rail, Palmtran, Brightline, the port, the airport, all of these together. And in addition, we're part of the Miami urbanized area. So to the feds, we're one area from here all the way down to Miami as one urbanized area. So we work collaboratively with Broward County and Miami-Dade County. We have to do a regional transportation plan across the three counties and also our own local long-range transportation plans. So our key planning documents were, as I mentioned, we're a federally designated agency. We're the Metropolitan Planning Organization for Palm Beach County. The three main products, or actually the two products that we do for planning, is a five-year transportation improvement program, which is a prioritized list of projects that we're funding with those state and federal dollars. We directly prioritize $50 million a year in state and federal funding, and a lot of that's through grants to our local municipalities, our county. We don't own or operate anything, so we give those grants to those operators and those roadway owners. And then we also, the board approves about $600 million a year of state and federal funding for our county that's going to things like I-95, different transportation projects across the county. And so this is a program of projects that we update and approve every year for the new outer year. We also have a plan that's 25 years out, the long-range transportation plan, currently to 2045. We're about to get started on 2050 update. And we look at how are we going to grow? How do we want to grow? What do we anticipate of the funding that we're going to have? What are the needs and desires? And where are we expecting people to move? In addition, this is not a required document, but we do a one-year strategic plan, just really focusing on what key things we want to study and do over the next year. I had a graphic here in terms of the life cycle of a project that Cassidy on our team created to demonstrate that these projects you plan and then you have to prioritize the funding, and then it's a whole life cycle for them to get designed and into this work program. So. Slide. So we saw a graphic from Jonathan's presentation about the space issue, right? We have a certain amount of space that the right-of-way owners or the local municipalities or the county owns for these roadways. And at a certain point, those roadways get full because the cars take up a lot of space, and you get to a point where you have to decide, are you going to widen and acquire more property? Are you going to double deck? And what we've learned from other areas is the more you widen, the more you're accommodating and inducing demand for cars, and it gets full over time anyway. So we're at that point in time where we have to start thinking about how are we going to move people more efficiently. Let's think about improving transit. Let's think about moving people regionally and into our downtowns. And Raphael and Alex and all of our speakers talked about you know, these walkable trips. And thinking about a lot of trips are within 1 and 3 miles. So people are going to drop off their kids at school. They're going to the post office. They're doing things that are creating traffic that could potentially be made by walking, biking, or taking a local circulator instead. So trying to create these multimodal communities. Our priorities are, we do have a complete streets policy. And that what that means is that we want to provide safe access for transportation users of all ages and abilities. That means that when you design a street, you think about the most vulnerable users first and not as an aftermath. When you're thinking about trips, every trip begins and ends as a pedestrian, whether you get into your car or you're walking to the parking lot. Having a complete streets policy, we're encouraging our municipalities to do that as well. It means that when you approve a development, you're thinking about what is that connection from the front door of the neighborhood Walmart or whatever it might be to the transit stop, to the sidewalk of the main network, really creating that connected community. And we're looking at safety. So we have a Vision Zero resolution, a policy and action plan. We're looking at how can we improve safety for all users? How can we prevent crashes that are fatal and create serious injuries? Trying to really prioritize safety, but that takes a multifaceted approach. It's 5 E's. It's engineering the roadways. How are we designing them? It's educating people how to behave. It's encouraging them to behave and walk and bike more. It's enforcing the people to behave correctly and evaluation, tracking that information over time. And ultimately, in this long-range transportation plan, we're really trying to create this mode shift of trying to plan for all modes, get more people to walk and bike and use more efficient ways of getting around. So there's lots of benefits of complete streets. More walkable streets means more eyes on the street, means more safety. It means more people are expecting people to be on the streets. It also means that they're looking more at the local shops or might be spending more money on the streets. It promotes health. It promotes sustainability. It really has a lot of benefits to the community, and it's more desirable. People want to live in walkable communities. But when we talk about this, it's not just about people that can drive and what they're choosing. Not everyone has the privilege to drive. Not everybody is old enough or young enough to drive. Not everybody has the physical ability to drive. Not everybody has the income level to drive. So we're talking about creating communities for everyone, and that benefits everyone in the end. So I mentioned we fund projects, we give grants. This is an example. This is A1A out of in Jupiter, just an example, trying to promote safety, trying to connect those sidewalks, trying to slow down traffic, trying to create a more walkable environment. This is near Guanabanas, if you're familiar with that area. But we provide grants like this that the communities ask us, hey, we don't have sidewalks. We don't have bicycle facilities. People are speeding down this road. Can you help us? And we provide grants for those types of things. So coming back to our mobility vision. As a region, we are growing. These are stats from our last update from our long-range transportation plan in the region, our regional transportation plan. So as a region, we're expected to grow up to 7.5 million people from 5.9 by 2045. In Palm Beach County, we're looking at nearing 2 million people in the next 20, 25 years. And so we think about how are we going to move all these people together? Broward and Miami-Dade County, they have passed funding sources to provide more enhanced transit, more frequent, reliable transit. But we are part of that public. We're part of that one traveling public across the three counties. The people don't stop at the county line. People are driving, they're visiting places, they're working across the county lines, and we need to think about how to move them. So in our last long-range transportation plan, we looked at our current transit network, which is the map on the left, and the light purple lines are the ones that are, it's our current existing system with PalmTran. We worked with PalmTran. We looked at what are the highest transit ridership routes today, in addition to also where would we like, we have the CSX with Tri-Rail, and then also the Brightline FEC line. What about other east-west connections, and where would it make sense to identify where's the most amount of people concentrated that we could potentially provide options to get them out of their cars. And so we looked at this network and we call it the 561 plan because it's five north-south corridors. It's US-1. It's the two rail lines. It's Congress and military in the six east-west, which is Okeechobee, Forest Hill, Lake Worth, Boynton, Atlantic, and Glades. This network of corridors, within this network, we have the highest concentration of crashes of people walking and biking. We also have the highest transit ridership, but we also, and these numbers are slightly higher today, but in the future, we capture 68% of all the population in the county within 2 miles and 94% of all non-farm jobs. So when we think about these people that are at least in this core area, trying to get them, where can we try to redevelop the land uses and make it more mixed use so people can not have to get into their car and continue to clog this system? Where can we provide other options for people, you know, to focus this redevelopment here? Because we are confined. It may be a blessing or a challenge, but we are confined by the ocean, by the Everglades, by different things that are grassy waters. We are confined in certain ways. So we want to focus the redevelopment in this area. And then we do have express bus service already that goes all the way to the Glades. And so that's people that are driving from the west into this core area that's getting really congested. At least we could potentially create some park and rides, but get some of the people that are creating this congestion in the core area out of their cars. So those other folks that are driving in, it's alleviating some of this traffic by mode shift. So when I say enhanced transit, and this is something that if we are going to get funding for the federal government, they look at where do you have the density of the people to provide this. So we're talking about really frequent, Limited stop service, about half a mile. We heard the magic number of 0.6 miles. So people don't want to walk more than that. So not stopping every 10 feet, but having every half a mile, and potentially it could mean bus rapid transit where you have dedicated bus lanes, or it could mean light rail where it's a dedicated light rail lane. The picture on the left is Phoenix, which actually for them, they implemented light rail. It cost $2 billion, but within 10 years, they had $12 billion of redevelopment and investment along the corridor. And then BRT light, which is basically a nicer bus, frequent, less stopping, level boarding, other types of transit single priority, other things that are enhancing it, but it's still mostly mixed traffic. So when we're thinking about how can we get some of these people out of their cars, how can we use the space more efficiently? We have to think about it needs to be equal or better than the car experience for people to get out of their cars. So we've developed this, in addition to this 5-6-1 plan, we have identified priority corridors that we want to really improve that those pedestrian and bicycle facilities, the green lines, the connecting to the blue lines. And then also some, we do need some roadway capacity projects, but as I mentioned in the core, we're starting to get built out. So we need to start thinking about moving people in different ways. So we've identified these desires, but our next steps are to study the corridors and work with the local municipalities on what's the locally preferred alternative for enhanced transit. What are the ped bike facilities that would fit within the right of way? And then what are the land uses that we could potentially redevelop in this really core area? We want to work with all the municipalities in our county on what is their local mobility vision, what are their desires to tie into this network, and then determine the total cost and the funding options to get there. So as a TPA, as an MPO, we're able to get capital dollars, but we can't get the operation dollars to provide that really frequent service. So we need to figure out what is it that we want, how much is it going to cost, and then how are we going to match with that local match the operations. And then create that roadmap for implementation and assist our local municipalities as we are today with complete streets, with mobility, with safety projects. I was just actually in Belgrade with the mayor 2 days ago. They've just passed a resolution for Vision Zero. They want to look into complete streets, and they're really trying to also, they have a, Palmtran has a Go Glades kind of on-demand service out there, but they're also, looking at how can we improve safety and mobility and then connect to the bus that does bring people, express into downtown, into the rest of the region. So trying to integrate all these things and talk about land uses, talking about redevelopment versus continuing to sprawl, and how do we create that car optional future. So we have studied US-1. We're working with the municipalities along the way. And with Palmtran, we've prioritized funding for electric buses, for level boarding stations, for transit single priority. Our next corridor that we're currently studying is Okeechobee Boulevard and State Road 7. So we're looking at what are the facts along this corridor within a half mile? What are the transit dependent communities? What are opportunities for redevelopment of land use and potentially what if the State Road 7 and Okeechobee corner where there's a Target in that location, what if that was a catchment area like a Rosemary Square or Meisner Park where people in Westlake, in Loxahatchee and Royal Palm could potentially take a local circulator or park and ride there, and it's a destination where they can live, work, play, or just go hang out there and then take a one seat ride into downtown and to the rest of the region. And it really is a convenient, reliable, frequent experience. So trying to figure out what are those catchment points and what are opportunities. Same thing with the Wellington Mall, working with Wellington, looking at, is that a potential catchment area to connect to this system? We are planning to do a public workshop here in this room on May 10th, so save the date. And that's the website for the study. So we're looking at land use, economic development, and transportation. If you, some of you may have seen this slide before, but you think about what are we planning for? What are we trying to encourage people to do? So this is Okeechobee at Palm Beach Lakes Boulevard looking east. It really looks like you're trying to encourage people to drive their cars. It's a very wide road. It's a high crash corridor for people walking. A lot of people are getting hit by cars walking and biking because they're trying to cross and they're trying to get to wherever they need to go, but primarily cars, and it's where we have car dealerships, We have gas stations and different things like that. So is that what we're trying to encourage on this corridor? Or do we want to have a parallel route like State Road 80 that might be an express bus and it might have really prioritized express lanes for cars, but this corridor is redeveloped for other things. So if you think about it, what if we have this corridor for dedicated transit, catching those people at least, you know, we have to start somewhere. Eventually it'd be great to connect the entire county, but at least we have to start somewhere. So what if we start from that State Road 7 to downtown with a dedicated frequent service, catching people along the way. And then we look at the land use as well. What if we start developing some of those underutilized land uses that are so close to downtown, but they're just, you know, not really the best use of that land to connect people to their jobs, to their education, to their opportunities that where they need to go. So does some people say, well, first you need the transit to get the land use, or they say, so that's one argument. We first need to get the transit to get the land use. So in downtown, it was already pretty developed and we got Brightline Station in 2016. And yes, we've had a boom of things that have happened since then. This is the view from our office. You have the new residential at Brightline. You have new Soleil right here in the corner, senior housing, a lot of different things have popped up just in the last 5 years around that station. It becomes a very attractive thing for developers. But then also there's the other argument. What if you have the land use, you do what you can with what you have, like Meisner Park, which actually became a very attractive location for Brightline to put in their investment for the station that's coming in, a new Brightline station. $46 million investment expected open later this year. So I guess the moral of the story is the chicken or the egg is do what you can with what you have. Try to create more walkable communities, try to create more transit-oriented communities, and really hopefully we can redevelop and better use some of the space, this land, to create more livable communities for all people. And I really want to encourage you to sign up for our newsletter. If you haven't, we have a ton of resources. Please reach out to us and follow our meetings and events. We are, as I mentioned, we're planning an Okeechobee State Road 7 workshop here in our offices to present some of the alternatives that we have evaluated for that study. And also we're planning a Vision Zero workshop in the next month or two as well. So with that, it's just kind of a overview. Our next steps from this mobility, the regional network that we have identified, as I mentioned, is to go out and work with each of the communities to identify what their desires are and how we can connect to the regional plan and create that roadmap. More and more working more closely with the cities, with economic development communities, with the private developers, that those public-private partnerships to leverage and really work collaboratively. So with that, I'm going to open it up for questions, and Melissa will handle the questions for the panel. Thank you so much, everyone, for being with us today and for your interest in this topic as well.
Thank you, everyone, for such great presentations today. It was very informative. I know we only have 15 minutes left, so we'll just try to keep it to a minute or so or a couple minutes per question. The first question that I have two online, so I want to try to get to a couple of those, but from the room, we'll start with Commissioner McKinley. She would like to know, as it becomes less affordable to live in the West Palm Beach downtown area, how do you encourage employees to travel downtown if they can't live downtown? So really, whoever is able to answer a question, just feel free to jump in.
I'll start there. Well, price is something we can't control that well. So the best way, we can't encourage employees to live downtown if they can't afford it. What we can do is create affordability around the area. The city's done a tremendous job of incentivizing affordable housing through the CRA, but we can also build transportation systems that allow people to live near or outside the area and get to and from it in an affordable way. That's the only way that the land use and affordability and transportation go all together like a puzzle. And we're never gonna solve the affordability puzzle challenge, I should say, without focusing on mobility. they are married forever.
And I'll tie into that. Maybe Gopal might have more of a perspective from the private sector on actually having enhanced trans and other options. There may be options to provide affordable housing and part of mixed use, but changing the landscapes and moving people closer, providing opportunities for them to live and not have to have the burden of owning a car also helps alleviate. So those photos I showed of Okeechobee and redeveloping some of these land uses closer, then people it may be more affordable for them to live. There might be affordable housing incentives from the city or the county, but then they're also not having to spend $500 or however much on a car and car insurance and gas that continues to increase. So now they don't have that burden.
Great answer.
And she also has a second question as well. A majority of workers live west. So we talked about a lot of great options for north, south, train, circuit, et cetera. If you're already downtown or along the north-south corridor with Tri-Rail and Brightline, those are obviously really great options. But she says it's becoming more difficult to move east-west. So anyone have thoughts on that?
Sure. And this goes to the 561 plan and that long range, looking at how are we going to move people? We're continuing to get more and more people. We need to find options. And so the 561 plan, those quarters that I mentioned that had the highest density of the people and the highest number of crashes, identifying certain quarters that we're going to move, we're going to prioritize moving people and not cars on those quarters, and having other quarters parallel routes. For example, if Okeechobee and Forest Hill have really nice, very safe walk, bike, and efficient transit, then Southern could be an express bus, but have very efficient movement for cars and prioritizing that. So finding options to move people east and west, certain corridors prioritized for certain things. And on the Okeechobee Forest Hill option is then you start redeveloping the land uses along them to have more people access that transit.
I'll just say that the graphic that Valerie showed at the end of her presentation of Okeechobee Boulevard with modest density built in along it and transit and other modes in the right of way is the most exciting picture I've seen as an urban planner in a very long time. So that's our vision. And that's how we solve that issue.
Okay, great. I'm going to move on to, I'm going to read two questions actually, because they both mention Brightline. So one of them also mentioned Circuit. So both of you feel free to jump in when you can. The first question is from Seth. He says, what are the public-private opportunities that Brightline thinks could work and what has worked? How can the TPA, cities, counties, et cetera, be involved and assist with this? And then Noah Brown says, Jonathan from Brightline and Alex from Circuit talked a lot about developing mobility hubs in their network. How can additional transit infrastructure, Palmtran, Tri-Rail, et cetera, in addition to the 18-plus park and ride lots in Palm Beach County, be utilized alongside Brightline and Circuit services to make more mobility hubs and connections from areas like West Boca, Wellington, Eastern downtowns, et cetera?
I heard her name mentioned, so I'll jump in on a couple of these. First off, public-private opportunities. I think it's actually really exciting if you look from across the country at Florida and see that this is where investments in inner city connectivity is happening with a public-private partnership, and it's happening faster and in some ways better here than any place else in the country. I think most places would be envious if they knew about what was happening here. Some don't. When they find out about it, they're envious. And there are opportunities to take that further. So it is definitely probably a best practice to find ways to leverage these inner city investments on like a right of way that has inner city rail that's going long distance and the commuter version of that, because there's extra capacity on the tracks in many cases in many ways. There's work across all the counties to leverage the Brightline right of way to do more. And that's, you know, that's work that the counties have to do, but that's an example of where this $5 billion private investment that goes between Miami and Orlando can be leveraged by local communities to do a lot more. Additionally, it goes beyond just the rail. So I think we'll see over the course of this year, like we launched Brightline Plus, which is this really audacious first and last mile connectivity effort. The most visible parts of that have been electric cars and shared vans, microtransit, taking people around. But it's not the only parts of this. So to answer both questions one and two, the circuit type investment where we have free vehicles operating around, we have opportunities over the course of this year to make our investment more efficient and expand the capacity for local communities by partnering. It doesn't make a lot of sense to have, you know, one circuit fleet over here paid by one entity and another circuit fleet over here paid by another entity. They're both doing the same things, but maybe they're not moving people as well, or it's harder for people to access it. So I think you'll see over the course of this year, a lot of work by us to work with cities that currently have stations and where future stations are, to make sure that we integrate our systems smartly so that we lower, like Alex was saying, that cost per rider to almost an unimaginably low level and move lots and lots of people. So that's one area where that that can happen. And also public transit in question number two was mentioned. So the other thing I think you'll see over the course of the year is how do we like deeply integrate our public transit with Brightline? That's the vision of Brightline Plus, is whatever option that you want to use or is best for you to get to the station, how do we help you do that easier? It really, it's the easy button. Like when we want to do mode shift, it's all about cost and convenience. So that requires collaboration. Cost and convenience are the only two levers that matter. Absolutely the only two levers that matter. So through collaboration, we can bring down costs. And also through collaboration, we can make the technology convenience, the time taken, or just the feeling of simplicity. That's all convenience. We can improve both of those. And that plays into the public transit system. I think, you know, we've already been doing experiments with Miami-Dade Transit on Metrorail, how to use our QR code that you enter the train with to also open Metrorail gates. When you're driving, you have one key. You have one key. So how do we work together with our public partners to make sure the non-driving option is also only one key? And how do we integrate that there's only one price tag for it, right? So when you're trying to get to the train station, if you have a $10 ticket to go to Fort Lauderdale, is it still just $10 when you take public transit there? And then how do we collaborate with the local jurisdictions, you know, to pay that extra $2? Maybe it's us, maybe it's local jurisdictions, or a mix. But those sort of collaborations are the smart opportunities that are available here and almost only here at this level, because almost no place else in the country has high-speed rail with a commuter rail impact. And we are, like, this is my whole job, is to energetically pursue these in partnership with great, great local partners on the public and private side.
Alex, anything you want to add to that?
I think it's interesting because a lot of these types of services, people just immediately think city. But if you want to sort of complete the full first and last mile, you need to have services on the other side. And I think while the density is not there, that's just simply fewer cars for that service. And somebody, you know, if there was a rapid bus line from, Wellington to downtown, but there was a way to get people to those stops, so there's fewer stops being taken on the rapid line and an easy way to connect there, then you can encourage utilization because somebody knows once they get here, they have a way to get around when they're here. So it's really, I think of it almost like a dumbbell where you have these pockets on both sides and you need to feed both of them so that somebody uses it. And to give an example, that the city of New Rochelle, New York was designed, our program there was designed to be a commuter shuttle, and they had a parking garage and they had leased out the spaces like many of the towns have in Westchester and Connecticut. And they were contemplating building a new parking garage for commuters. And instead they found that it would be better to have a mobility solution to get people to and from the train station so they're not adding more parking in the area. That program's gone really well. And then during the pandemic, it was a little bit of a, oh no, what's going to happen here? Because there's a lot less people commuting from New Rochelle to Manhattan. And surprisingly, they actually added more cars because they found that a lot of people were using it to get to the grocery store, to get to testing centers. There was visiting healthcare workers. New Rochelle was hit really hard by the pandemic. So it was able to really adapt to the community and in a surprising way that we hadn't anticipated. So I think there's a huge application for last mile transportation in, you know, areas outside of downtown. But I think it's just a product of, you know, if it's not quite as dense, then maybe you have larger vehicle types or you have fewer vehicles. But it's a necessary component to sort of completing, you know, the whole first and last mile experience.
Thank you. I think we have time for one more question. So I'm going to ask one of the ones that was from Zoom. If we didn't get to your question, we will absolutely follow up with you. I have your names here. We have your contact information from you registering. So we'll make sure we do get back to you if we didn't answer your question. If you're able to stay and you would like to speak with Valerie or one of the speakers who's able to stay a little bit longer, please feel free to come talk to us after. So this question has been a hot topic. So with the square and discussion of another convention center hotel, what does the TPA or other entities envision for pedestrian crossing for Okeechobee Boulevard? Narrowing and few lanes or building a pedestrian bridge? So whoever wants to answer that one, go for it.
It's funny, I just got asked this question on a panel. I was on at the Kravis yesterday, so it seems to be a hot topic. I think that, you know, obviously with the convention center expansion, convention center hotel expansion, that's a hot topic right now as the city and the county grows. In terms of a bridge going across Okeechobee, we have always been of the mindset that we're ready to be at the table with the county, the city, and anyone and you know, the CVB to have that discussion. I wouldn't say today that we have an opinion on whether it's the right thing to do or not, but I will say that there's a lot of discussion and a lot of research that needs to go into what the right solution is to get across Okeechobee. So that's my point.
I'll jump in. We in the Okeechobee Corridor study, and Okeechobee is a FDOT roadway, so we it is one of the roadways we can directly prioritize funding and do things with that roadway, obviously working with the county in collaboration with the city and the private developers. But we are evaluating currently pedestrian bicycle improvements, where this enhanced transit could potentially go in the planning level study, but also more recently, we've been talking about with the city, who's actually updating their mobility plan. Gwen left the room, but she's working on this. Other ideas out of the box that we want to look at potentially. What if it's, you know, what if the transit does come down the middle? What if there is other options such as a pedestrian plaza on top, some cars, but could a tunnel be possible? Are there other things that we could fix? Because this really is a tricky location. You have I-95 north and south dumping into downtown. You have Southern to Australian dumping into downtown, and you have two train lines. So all of these car trips, all of a sudden dumping into a new environment that's a more pedestrian, you know, walkable environment, how do we fix that? So that's definitely something that the TPA wants to help collaborate all the partners together and look at options to solve that solution. And I'll let Raphael jump in because I know that they're working on updating their mobility plan and looking at different things as well.
Well, the whole idea of the mobility plan, we don't have enough time for that right now. But I'll just say this about the idea of a bridge over Okeechobee Boulevard. Okeechobee east of Australian Avenue isn't a suburban arterial anymore. It's two urban streets. It's Lakeview going west and Okeechobee going east. And we need to think of that as a design challenge to make the road fit the context that it's now in. When it was built, there wasn't a lot there, but there's a lot there now and more coming. And we need to think of Okeechobee and Lakeview as streets, not big suburban arterials. That's the first challenge. And then I'll just say that the idea of a pedestrian bridge is a slippery slope, in my opinion, because if we build that bridge and it's in one location, there's going to be one bridge. And then do we then say, if you want to cross Okeechobee, that's where you cross it. So we can continue to have this high speed, big road in a context that it doesn't work. My point in that is, does the bridge become the sort of fix that then doesn't really fix the problem? It works for the very small number of people, in my opinion, that would actually use it. But the rest of the people that are trying to cross that road are going to be left without a good, safe option.
Well, thank you everyone so much. Like I mentioned, if you are one of these people who gave me a card and I didn't get to your question, please come up and talk to us if you're able. If not, we'll definitely follow up with you. I'm going to pass it over to Valerie to wrap things up.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for the great questions and the participation today. This was a topic of interest that we wanted to have this amazing panel of speakers to talk about mobility and economic development, but we hope to have more events like this on topics of interest. We hope to have more guest speakers such as Palmtran, Tri-Rail, or other topics. So we will be sending out a survey asking folks, what are the transportation topics you would like to talk about? And please stay tuned with the Okeechobee study. Okeechobee downtown discussion is to be continued with all the partners. But I want to thank all of our speakers today. Amazing presentations. Our board members, our elected officials that came and joined us today as well. And also Alex as well from Circuit. We talked about Circuit today, but there are other providers. There's, you know, just as there are in micromobility, different providers for bike share. There's other cities that have freebie or other types of similar service. But we really appreciate that perspective of you know, kind of what are some of these solutions for first, last mile and these local communities. So again, thank you all so much for staying with us. And we're here to answer additional questions. Thank you.